We have several bills up today for a public hearing and possible work sessions. The first bill up is House Bill 2238, so we'll go into public hearing on that House bill. I will mention that we have received amendments to 2238, and I just got them literally as I walked down the hall. They're going to ask Patsy to make about 25 copies of those amendments. And I will tell you what the amendments do. The dash A7 amendments, which are amendments to the majority report, take out the, leave in the provision regarding what I'll call the pharmacist exception, but take out the more generic language changes which allowed professionals to, in effect, seek out independent contractor status. And again, these were just handed to me as I walked down the hall. I've asked staff to have copies made, and we'll have those copies put out as soon as they're ready so people can evaluate them. But I wanted to give you that heads up. That's a proposed compromise on the majority report. I have got a first witness up. Well, I'm going to call Annette Talbot, since she is a proponent of the measure, rather than Nancy Cabe. I'll call you and a couple of people down, Nancy, when after we hear about the bill. Annette Talbot, good morning. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, Annette Talbot, Legislative Coordinator for the Employment Department. While I have not seen the actual amendments, I did have a discussion with Representative Mannix about the amendments in a conceptual way on Friday. With the Chair's permission, however, I would like to speak to the other provisions in the bill, since this is a new bill for this committee. 2238 started out as the department's bill, actually, to address a court case and clarify the department's authority as an insurance company to be sure that they could always address the nature of a separation, if a separation was a quit or it was a discharge. There was evidence on the record that the department, be it at the initial stage of the filing of a claim or all the way through the appeals board, should have the discretion to administer the insurance program and make the decision whether something is covered or not. As you might know, although this is not the topic that's traditionally in front of this committee, generally speaking, if you're unemployed through no fault of your own, you are entitled to collect unemployment insurance. However, if you quit without good cause, you are not. So it's important that the department or a representative of the department up through the appeals board have the authority to make a call about whether the facts reflect a quit or a discharge. That's important for experience rating for employers as well, so that it's truly an experience-based system, so that the department can make consistent decisions about whether something is a quit or a discharge. As well, there were other amendments added to the bill in the House Business and Consumer Affairs Committee, which you will see on page 3 of the engrossed bill. Subsection 11 was an amendment proposed by former Representative Bob Shiprack, addressing an issue that he had concerns about in a collective bargaining situation where a project is about to come to completion. Many times management will come to the workers and say, we need 5 of you to go by the end of this week. It's an issue of some 5 members of the union are going to have to leave. It's just a matter of some of the crew volunteering to leave. And that has been troublesome for the union and their concerns were that sometime a referee or administrative law judge would interpret that as someone quitting, when in fact they're just volunteering to be one of the crew that's going to be laid off. So subsection 11 on page 3 would clarify that, in fact, that is still considered a layoff because some members of the crew are going to leave. Subsection 12 addresses a situation relating to domestic violence victims. The members may recall that this was in another bill that was before them on the House floor, and it relates to allowing domestic violence victims to be able to quit and have that considered for good cause, which is one of the exceptions where you can receive benefits. Current administrative law allows an individual to quit for compelling personal circumstances, but it does not address specifically the domestic violence. So this would put that in statute so people could read the law and understand that that was acquit with good cause. And they could also understand the kinds of alternatives that they would need to pursue before they quit. The troublesome part for the department and the governor, and you can see it attached to our handout, is a letter from the governor in relationship to this bill and to other bills that have been proposed this session that would exclude people from unemployment insurance coverage. Although Representative Mannix's proposed amendments would narrow who is excluded, the department at this point would still be opposed to the bill. We do have a meeting this afternoon with the governor's staff to confirm that he would still be opposed to those amendments, and we see that the bill is scheduled tomorrow, so we would be able to confirm that tomorrow morning. But the amendments, as I understand them, would still, I haven't been able to actually read through them, so perhaps we'll have a little bit of an opportunity after you hear from other speakers, if the chair would indulge us, to come back up. But as I understand them, they would still exclude the temporary pharmacists. We are in litigation about this issue, so I can't really speak to the case directly, but I will say that on the third bullet on the handout on the bottom, one of the things that we would be very concerned about the pharmacist exclusion is that we don't see any difference between these temporary pharmacists and any other temporary employee agency where they refer out temporary employees, whether it be attorneys, computer specialists, clerical. There's lots of temporary agencies that when they refer those people, they still are their employees and someone does cover them for unemployment insurance, usually the temporary agency. So we don't believe that there's any distinction that is warranted in regards to pharmacists any differently than any other temporary agency employees. So that would be why, at this point, we would understand that the governor would still be opposed to the bill, but I will certainly review the amendments and get back to the committee on that and the discretion for tomorrow to give you a final decision from the governor's office after I meet with them. Mr. Chair, I hope that's a quick summary of what the bill does.
All right, thank you, Representative Pazanski.
Mr. Chair, this is more for staff and for yourself. We just got the Dash 7s, which I think are dated today. Is there other ones that we're going to be considering with the bill besides the Dash 7?
No. The numbering just goes back to the earlier committee work. Good question, though.
Mr. Chair, certainly the department and the governor's office would be able to support the bill again if we were to delete sections 4 through 6 and amend section 7 to apply only to the first part of the bill. So if the committee wished to have a bill that could go forward without opposition, that would be what we would propose. Thank you.
The only problem is the chair of the committee has to be willing to convene a work session for that to happen.
I understand that, Mr. Chair. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Nancy Cave, why don't you come up now, please, and explain the particular exception, which is still an issue, and we'll have your testimony circulated.
This is Section 2.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chairman Mannix and members of the committee, my name is Nancy Eschmeyer Cabe, and I own and operate a temporary pharmacist business, a small business out of my home for the last 12 years. My business is a brokerage for independent pharmacists to contract their services on a temporary basis, and I've kind of made a little place where these pharmacists are very pleased and proud to work for themselves. I guess you have to kind of understand the pressure that's on pharmacists these days, and you might, as you think of Rite Aid and the problems that have happened with Rite Aid, pharmacists are under tremendous pressure, and they really, the people that work through me really like to work for themselves. It's very important to them, and you probably have gotten some email from some of these individuals. It's very important to them. He may have met me through some of my past volunteer work with the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. I am a past president, and I'm currently the vice chair of the American Pharmaceutical Association's PAC committee. I work as an independent pharmacist along with many of the professionals who contract through my brokerage and take great pride in being independent and are grateful for the freedom of choice that this represents, like so many before me that have fought to preserve in this state and country. The ability to work hard as a free and independent business is the cornerstone of the entrepreneurial spirit that supports the successful foundation of our country. Millions of foreign immigrants left their homes to come here for this opportunity, not allowed in their homelands to work hard and be free to succeed. We must be ever vigilant to keep these privileges open and the opportunity alive in this country. You will find the Employment Division is lobbying heavily against this bill. We have to understand that their state of mind is that there should not be any independent contractors. They would like everyone to be an employee, and I'm sitting here saying to you that everyone doesn't want to be an employee. The way we have written this law, anyone who would like to be an employee is very free to be. There are pharmacies out there that are closed because there aren't any employee pharmacists. People that broker through me do so because they wish not to be an employee. I just want to make sure that you understand that point. The history of the statute is as follows. There was a conflict in 1989 that created the need to change the statute around independent contractors revolving around the building industry. The committee felt that although the language centered around the building industry, a common sense interpretation would guide decisions in regards to other independent contractors. The legislature could not have foreseen that state agencies would narrowly interpret the law to disregard their intentions, as has occurred in my case, which is presently on appeal. The agency's own rules dictate that they follow the intent of the legislature, but they have not.
Let me interrupt for a moment. You realize, of course, that this bill is prospective rather than retroactive, so it will not affect your
plan. I guess, if you don't want to go, you need to go through all this. The reason that I'm here is because the law that is in place right now does not address professionals. Professionals, if it is interpreted the way it has been interpreted in my case, cannot be free business people. And that's why I'm here, because that's not right.
But what I'm trying to get at is you're looking to the future rather than the past.
That's right. I guess you can read what has happened to me and what the law is that is in the past.
And what happened, you had some litigation involving the federal internal revenue people about independent contractor versus employee. What happened there?
I won. My pharmacists under federal law can be brokered through me and work as independent contractors. I also have been cleared by the revenue department of the state that the pharmacists can work as independent contractors.
Does the employment department have a position as to why the revenue department is wrong?
They feel they should be able to make their own decisions. They feel that each department can make their own decisions. In other words, I would have to go through this three different times and spend huge sums of money legally. They feel they should each be able to make their own decision.
All right. Did any members of the committee have any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for seeing me.
Rich Peppers and Mary Botkin. Sure. Oh, well, Carlton Grew, too, please. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
How are you this morning?
For Monday and yourself?
Always peachy. Does mean I need to fasten my seatbelt?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rich Peppers with the Oregon Public Employees Union. And I distributed some written testimony, which obviously was prepared before the amendments this morning came in, and I haven't had a chance to really study the amendments thoroughly, so obviously these may not reflect any more of the current status or the likely status of the bill. However, we thought it would be okay just to come ahead and give you some of our feedback on the bill. We were concerned about, in particular, the amendments in sections 4 through 6. There are some concerns we have both about the general exclusions from or changes in the independent contractor language and test, as well as in the more specific exemption for the pharmaceutical agencies.
I think you can assume for purposes of the future of this bill that assuming reasonable minds can prevail that the provision which you most object to relating to the professionals and to being able to be independent contractors could be stripped out of the bill. What's left is making it clear, as I believe case law makes it clear, but we'll hear from Annette Talbot later on that, that the specific independent contractor laundry list statute, that subsection 600 that's always referred to, is a way of guaranteeing independent contractor status, but isn't the only way to achieve it. And secondly, dealing with the specific exemption of licensed pharmacists who contract through a brokerage to do temporary work in various places. I'll mention to you that the specific rationale for that exception ties to specific circumstances. I remember when Bob Shuprack introduced the golf caddy exception. I was there. I voted for it, I think. He probably broke my arm to get me to do so. He had a very interesting rationale as to why they were in specific circumstances, and I remember that before my time, the Oregonian had all kinds of good reasons why newspaper carriers should have a specific exception. But in this case, the federal government requires that any pharmacy operation be at a fixed location. So you can't set up your own little cottage industry as a pharmacist and operate out of your home unless that becomes licensed, or operate out of the trunk of your car. You have to work through a fixed location. And there's strict controls because there are controlled substances involved. And the rationale is that if you want to be a pharmacist and be an independent contractor, you need to be able to work with various fixed locations. You cannot just operate out of your bag. Pharmacists don't get to make house calls unless they're operating out of a fixed location. And the idea being that this gives them a specific opportunity to be independent contractors if they wish. And I'm just explaining it to you. I'm not making the pitch to you. But that's the rationale for that specific exception. Even lawyers can operate out of their briefcases if they want to. There's no federal law that says they have to have a specific situs. But why don't you go ahead and state your general concerns about those provisions for the record so we can get them in here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in fact, some of what I'd like to do is give Mr. Grew, who came up with me, who's the attorney for OPEU, a chance to speak to those particular concerns. But I just wanted to come up along with him and say that we do have, if the bill is changing, some of our concerns are obviously going away, but the exemption, this particular exemption, would still be an issue for us as well.
But you would probably feel very good about having achieved a great deal of what you wanted to achieve in terms
without
of
even
changing this bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just a few comments. And again, I'm speaking somewhat to the pre-amendment version, but just to maybe reinforce any intentions.
Well, please state your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Carlton Grew with OPEU.
OPEU. Yeah, is it Grew?
The Oregon Public Employees
Union. No, your last name.
Grew, G-R-E-W.
Thank you.
One of the I guess there's a philosophical issue that is pretty important legally. The professional status amendments would change the focus of the law from the nature of the employment relationship to the type of employee or the type of education and training and insurance of the worker. It would set up a disincentive, I think, for people to carry professional liability insurance, which I think is represents troublesome public policy. And it also is a matter that is generally individual choice. As a matter of fact, I, as in-house counsel for OPEU, do not have to carry professional liability insurance, but I've chosen to do so because of a prior case or two that I have carry over. In fact, the breadth of that language might even include my status, because I'm not supervised by someone working in an attorney capacity. So I might end up arguably not being an employee, although unquestionably in terms of my work I am. And as far as the pharmacy exception is concerned, obviously that has a significantly less impact. However, I appreciate the chair's focus on the choice of the individual workers involved, but of course the employment relationship isn't always subject to the worker's choice alone. And I would simply encourage the committee to take a hard look at issues where people have the option at the employer's option being deprived of a status they might otherwise would want.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mary Botkin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. And you could see me diligently working here with your amendments, trying to see what they did. And I think that based on what you said, probably a lot of our concerns would be met. As you know, we represent a large number of professional classes throughout the state of Oregon, many of which require some kind of professional insurance. And we represent folks in professional classes kind of across the board, from OHSU, where we actually represent the pharmacy techs and the pharmacists, all the way over to engineers and industrial hygienists. So, you know, the whole idea of changing those definitions to encompass more of our professional classes makes us a little nervous. And let me just say, Mr. Chair, that I'm prepared to work with you and your committee to make sure that those concerns are addressed and that we can move forward on the bill.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your coming this morning. Herb Fletcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I could be joined by Brother Shipwreck.
Oh, yes, Brother Shipwreck.
Brother
good morning.
Shipwreck.
We need institutional memory on this bill. And
I already used the, I already took former Representative Shipwreck's name in vain.
You invoked his name, yes, you did. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Herb Fletcher with the Oregon AFL-CIO. And the concerns we had were the same that Rich and Annette and Mary enunciated. I'm speaking on behalf today, though, of the Employment Division Advisory Committee, a committee of both labor and management. And we had many original concerns, but by the way, here's one of the labor members of our committee right here. But I can't go on record with the new amendments unless I get back to the committee, but hopefully you're going to deal with our concerns and we can support the bill, because within this bill is 2813, which is a major piece forward for workers on unemployment insurance. I know the chair realizes that.
And Mr. Fletcher, you were so convincing in your objections and some of the other documents that we've stripped away the heart of the matter involving your objections with this proposed amendment.
Thank you. Brother Shipwreck.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bob Shipwreck, Oregon Building Trades, but here representing, wrong committee, Unemployment Advisory Committee. I've been asked by some individuals today, Mr. Chairman, to go through a very brief history of independent contractor law. I can't remember if you were on the interim committee when we wrote that or not.
1989. I suffered through the work group.
You were on it. We spent, the House Labor Committee at that time spent an entire interim on rewriting, we rewrote Oregon's independent contractor law. We didn't have one prior to that. Each agency that enforces these statutes used a different test, and that was the problem. You had employment using one test, revenue using another, workers' comp using another, and so you had individuals who unwittingly were getting fined or in trouble because employment perhaps said they were independent and revenue said, no, you're not, so we tried to make them all common.
Then you probably noticed the irony then with the pharmacists where revenue said they're not and employment said they are, but I'll let you pick up
that. That caught my attention, Mr. Chairman. In fact, I asked Annette about that. Apparently, that whole thing is on appeal somewhere, and because, as you'll recall, what the intent of it was that all state agencies that enforce employment law recognize one common definition. Also mentioned that you're absolutely correct, speaking just to, I think it's the final section of the bill, one of the things we said was, all right, we've developed a common test, and I should mention the Internal Revenue Service at that time worked with us and said that they wished they had our test under federal law because it was, as you used to call it, Mr. Chairman, a bright line standard. And in fact, in Congress, there are proposals to rewrite the federal independent contractor law, which is a test of about 21 common law areas. Getting to my point, you've already spoken to it, however, Mr. Chairman, that we've never wanted to see the independent contractor test changed because of the changes that the long time that went into doing that. However, at the time, you might recall, we did not eliminate the current exemptions from unemployment insurance that exist, and I forget how many there were at that time. I think we added a couple, including golf caddies, although I introduced it for somebody. I voted against that bill.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay. We all have our names on bills. We just do not. But, so you're absolutely correct, Mr. Chair. If the legislature were to choose to carve out, if you will, an exemption, that's still within their purview. But my concern, as well as others, is that we tamper with the test that we have, which has served Oregon very well for the last 10 years and has gotten, in fact, national recognition. So if there's any questions on some of this history, whatever, I think you're well aware of it, though.
Representative Fazansky.
Mr. Chair, just for my understanding, so about 10 years ago is when all of the different tests from the different agencies were consolidated mm-hmm. into what we have today.
That's correct.
And has there been any changes of significance to that test since it has come into play?
No, it has not been changed, to my knowledge. It's an eight-step test.
My analogy would be to the public records law, where we made a policy decision at one point to just say all records are public records and are available unless we have exceptions, and we have a standard. Two different statutes for that. One where they're pretty much locked up. Another where if the public interest overweighs the interest in privacy, those records are more accessible. But then we realized that with that approach, you from time to time develop exceptions. So we took a pretty aggressive role towards redefining the employment law. But over the years, specific situations have arisen that call for exceptions. The proposal here now would be, if we amend it properly, to say, all right, forget the big policy move here, mm-hmm. but let's talk about an exception. Now, I'll say that I was an advocate for this exception in the 95 session.
Remember that.
When I was a legislator. Then as a private citizen, I was an advocate for this, representing Nancy Cave. Then I withdrew from that representation. Then I went into the Senate. Now I'm back in the House, and the issue's still out there. I don't have any relationship with Nancy Cave professionally, but philosophically, this thing still bugs me a little bit, which is why I keep picking at it. But that's why it's in front of us.
I think
but you've made a very good case about these broader policy concerns, and I think that it's important to note that when our friends in the labor movement raise these issues, the concerns are noted, and we're trying to address that. So that's sort of a little bit of a positive feedback.
Just in closing, Mr. Chairman, if I might, the policy question I guess the committee has is, and one that we wrestled with in 89, where a lot of the economy was much different then, and people were asked to be exempted from employment taxes in order to get a job. They then subsequently lost employment either through getting hurt or laid off, and lo and behold, they and their families had no benefits. And that's something that has to be weighed, as well as how really, truly independent these particular people are. So those.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Tricia Smith. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith, and I represent Oregon School Employees Association. And at this point, I find it kind of interesting that I'm sitting here before you, but as long as I'm here, I do have some concerns still about the bill. My interaction with House Bill 2238 began in the House Business and Consumer Affairs Committee when we were attempting to add the amendment to the bill to incorporate protections for domestic violence victims and employers of those victims when situations arise where the victim must leave employment in order to be safe from the abuser who may be stalking her or him at the workplace. And that was the day that, in addition to that amendment, sections 4, 5, and 6 were added, and 7 were added to the bill, and that broadened our interest. School employees are one of those exceptions to unemployment insurance. We don't have a particular public policy reason, as far as school employees are concerned, why we are accepted from receiving the benefits of unemployment that virtually all other employees receive in Oregon. However, that does make us sensitive to changes in the unemployment insurance system, particularly at a time when both nationally and throughout the other states in the union, there is and has been for some time movement to incorporate workers into the system because it's good, sound public policy, good economic policy, and protects communities. So to remove employees from that system should require a great deal of consideration. So at this point, given the amendment and what is left in the bill, I will say that we still oppose sections 4 and section 6 of the bill, and suggest to you that if you are going to add another test, another series.
I need to explain that section 4 is all being subsection 4.
Section 4, I understand lines 38 and 39 still exist, the amendment, in the amendment with, and that addition will cause another series of tests that could be applied to independent contractors or to employees to determine whether or not they're independent contractors, and would change the definition for the employment department and make it different from the definition that's used by the other agencies with regard to employees.
I need to explain something on that. There's actually been the case law, for sure, in the area of workers' compensation, which says that the 670.600 is not the exclusive standard for determining it. It's if you meet that standard, you're guaranteed independent contractor status, but they still look to the rest of the definitions of the workers' compensation chapter to determine whether there's an employer-employee relationship. I don't know if there's similar case law in the employment context. I brought this up with Annette Talbot on Friday, and she indicated she would check that out. And I don't know what the context is for revenue, but apparently there's already been a revenue ruling, and for instance, in the CABE case, which is contrary to the Employment Department ruling. Maybe we, this independent hearings agency, ought to have consolidated hearings as to these issues so that we can get them resolved once and for all. But I just wanted to clarify that. Please go ahead.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, and that speaks to my last point, which deals with both the change in Section 4 and the change in Section 6, in that, and my concern is a process concern. These amendments, I believe, are significant for a large number of employees in the state, and in order to make a change that is that substantive for employees determining whether or not they are employees and eligible for unemployment insurance should require a great deal of investigation and deliberation by this body. So far, that has not occurred.
I should mention again that, however, the Section 6 changes, this is the third legislative session in which that particular issue has arisen. So that particular issue has been heavily discussed and debated.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. I would point out, however, it didn't pass in either of those sessions, and we have a lot of new folk here. So it does, as I said, it does affect a great deal of a great number of employees, and you should, I think, have a very clear understanding of the impact of these changes before you make them. And with that, and one other aside, Mr. Chair, I appreciated your analogy with attorneys. And how there may be some similarity between attorneys and pharmacists as they appear in Section 6. And I would only say that only on a few instances can attorneys actually kill you if they don't do it right. And so that is not correct. That is not correct for pharmacists. And so there is very good reason why they must be in a fixed site. And I don't think it would be appropriate to determine that because they have to be in a fixed site means they can be independent contractors rather than employees if they don't want to be employees. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. One of the things I'll encourage Nancy Cave to do is to talk to the folks from the labor movement to explain her particular circumstances so you understand a little more of the history, because that brokerage goes back several years, and that might be helpful, Ms. Cave, if you would do that. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2238? Annette, did you want to come back? Welcome back.
Mr. Chair, members, Annette Talbot again, Legislative Coordinator from the Employment Department. Wanted to just clarify a couple things that I believe the previous speakers had referenced. First, we are concerned about the consistency issue. Department of Revenue, Construction Contractors Board, and the Employment Department now use the test that you see attached to our testimony, which people have been referring to as 670-600. But it is an 8-part test that is fairly straightforward. You don't have to go and look at the case law. And as Representative Shipwreck indicated, the IRS is envious of our position that people can establish it by just reading the statute as opposed to getting a lawyer.
Let me ask you a question about that. So would the Employment Department support me now in the proposal I made 4 years ago that each of the agencies subject to that statute be bound by a determination of one of the other agencies subject to that statute?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that except for workers' comp, because of case law that you've referenced, where workers' comp is now no longer bound by that statute, and we believe that we should revisit that they're not, but that's certainly a discussion we need to have with the Workers' Compensation Division. But for Department of Revenue, Employment Department, and Construction Contractors Board, it is my understanding now that we do consistently enforce the test. So I'd like to clarify for the record that it is my understanding that the only reference that Ms. Cabe had to a State Department of Revenue finding was for 1991, and it was in an informal process with a revenue employee. And we are in litigation about that case, so I don't really feel that it's appropriate for us to talk more about that. But the hearing's decision did reference that 1991 informal conference. Generally speaking, because the Employment Department has 97,000 employers, we are the one who makes the test. When it comes to someone filing a claim for benefits, and we determine whether or not they were supposed to be an employee or whether they were independent contractor. We are in no way saying that Ms. Cabe needs to change the way she does business. We are just saying that her workers are employees and they deserve to have insurance coverage just like other employees. So we're not suggesting that she needs to make them do anything that they're not doing now. They can continue to have the flexibility that they have, but we do believe that they are employees under the law. The A7 amendments would make our test inconsistent with Department of Revenue and Construction Contractors Board as I read it. But if the chair wished to clarify what he understands subsection 3 to do now in section 4, that would be helpful, because it is my understanding from our conversations that you would like that to mean that an individual could use the federal common law test to establish themselves as an independent contractor.
Well, when I was on the work group back in 1989 and we developed what I call the laundry list, it was my understanding that that was a test system that was used, that if you met those standards, you were guaranteed independent contractor status, but it wasn't the sole and exclusive method that had to be used. And in fact, subsequent litigation developed that theory, and I wasn't involved in that litigation, but I saw the decisions and said that no, that's one method, but if you otherwise establish independent contractor status under whatever chapter was appropriate, it was okay. Now, the policy issue, which I tried to raise in 1995, which is probably boring this committee terribly because we deal with criminal law issues usually, was this. I had a bill that just said, okay, as to a given set of circumstances, if an agency makes a determination one way or another, all agencies subject to that statute should be bound by that determination. And in 95, the Employment Department came in and said, oh, no, you can't make us do that. We have to be able to make our own determination, and because otherwise we're not in compliance with federal law, which was an interesting point. So I'd be curious as to whether the Employment Department would like to see a unitary standard that we, by state law, apply to all agencies who are subject to that statute, and I'd be happy to provide it for you if you'd like to have that.
Mr. Chair, I'd be certainly happy to have the tax manager come up and talk to you about the history of that, since I did not represent the department in 1995. The only finding that I'm aware of in the Cabe case was an informal conference,
I'm
which certainly
about
wouldn't
Cabe.
Be bound
no,
by.
No. I'm not talking Cabe case now. I'm talking policy, this unitary standard, and all the agencies subject to it. That's something to think about.
It's something to think about, Mr. Chair, and we would actually certainly welcome a discussion about whether or not the 670-600 test, the 8-part test that was created a decade ago with business and labor support, and was adopted bipartisan support in the legislature, needs to be amended at some point in time. It's been a decade-long test. It's been there. If there are things that don't work about the test, we should suggest that that is what we study. However, as the chair knows, you spent several months during session doing that, and we're not sure at this point in time that that would represent a good use of the members' time at this point in session, but we would certainly be willing to do that during the interim because we do understand that the nature of work is changing. And that perhaps some of those things need to be revisited, but we don't believe creating a new third test is the way to go because, again, the Department of Revenue does not use the federal common law test, it is my understanding, and neither does the Construction Contractors Board. They only use the recipe test. So we would be back to having inconsistent tests among the agencies, and we believe that's going in the wrong direction.
Can you imagine the frustration of the citizen, however, who is told that all these agencies say they're following the same statutory test, however, each one of them is going to have its own proceedings, its own hearing process, and make its own decision, and none of them are bound to consider the decision. They can certainly consider it, but they're not bound by the decision of another agency on the same set of facts.
Mr. Chair, if you'd like the tax manager to address that, my understanding is that all the agencies have an administrative rule that does say that they are bound by the Employment Department's decision, and we do make the primary decision since we do cover the majority of the employers in the state.
If you provide us with a copy of that rule.
I would be more than happy to. I believe that the two previous speakers also indicated that the advisory committee that we have, it's a governor-appointed committee, have been concerned about this erosion of coverage issue and don't generally support any more workers being excluded. And I believe it will be the governor's policy next session to revisit the current impermissible exclusions. The golf caddy one, for instance, I know I was a staff person in 1993 when that was added in the Senate Labor Committee. Some of those do need to be revisited to see why they're excluded, and I believe that is the governor's position.
I didn't understand the term impermissible exclusion.
Impermissible exclusion, Mr. Chair, is referenced on the back of the governor's letter.
Oh, but that's his term, not a statutory term.
It's actually a term the Department of Labor, I believe, uses, which means that there is no federal exclusion from coverage for those pharmacists. What would happen, therefore, is any employers who employ pharmacists like that would have to pay the full 6.2% federal tax. They would not get an offset of their 5.4% state tax. So those employers would have to pay a higher federal tax. Now, that might be advantageous for some employers and not for others. But again, it does exclude workers from coverage, and that is the general policy that the governor opposes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else that wanted to test? Oh, excuse me, Representative Pruzanski has a question.
One question regarding the situation that's before us regarding the contracting of independent pharmacists. If those individuals were making outreach and contacting pharmacists on their own, would there be a problem that we have now in the sense of it sounds to me that what I'm hearing you say is that because there's a clearinghouse for these individuals, that they should be employees of that clearinghouse as compared to them being on their own and contracting independently with each of the different pharmacies they service?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pruzanski, it's a very good question. The case, and I'd certainly be happy to give you a copy of the hearings decision, but the case rested on a couple issues at the hearings level, one of which included the fact that those individuals did not have representation to the public, that they were an independent contractor and therefore serving lots of other clients. So that was an issue. One of the parts of...
Yeah, let me ask before you go to the next one. Since their services are limited to a very exclusive clientele as compared to the general public, I mean, isn't there some difference there? I mean, they can't provide services to myself or you as individuals, but their clientele would be other pharmacists, which may not need to be advertised in the same sense.
Mr. Chair, the issue is whether or not under the test, 7600 requires that you be contracting with more than one other individual, which they did not. At least some of the individuals did not in her case. So that's the having the financial independence from one employer. That's the, one of the pieces that was not met, as my understanding, in the hearing decision. So, but again, I'm not an expert on that case, and I'm not sure that it's appropriate to have that discussion. But generally speaking, the test does require that you contract with more than one person. So in some cases, I don't, you know, in her case, I'm not as intimately familiar with it as she is, I'm sure. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. This concludes the hearing on House Bill 2238. We'll now move into public hearing on Senate Bill 735. And I'll ask Mr. Horton to summarize the measure and apologize to my colleagues for making you sit through our 45-minute colloquy on this other bill, but that's your beginning lessons on employment law.
Mr. Chairman, in regards to Senate Bill 735, A and Gross, current law provides that inmates are not to possess certain things, such as, of course, drugs, weapons, chainsaws, or files, and that includes money. However, there are work release programs which allow inmates to work and to earn some money as an incentive, but to prohibit the inmates from possessing money, and that is referred to as contraband, does fly in the face of what the work release programs try to do. What this bill would do is to provide that while an inmate still, of course, may not possess contraband, that that does not include any monies which are authorized by an inmate in a work release facility.
First witness, Rob Gates, Washington County. Good morning and welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Rob Gates. For the record, I have work at the Washington County Community Corrections Center. I've been manager there for approximately 15 years. I would just add a few bits of information in addition to what the Mr. County Council had provided, also an explanation of the bill. For the first two decades in operation of our center, and up until approximately 2 years ago, we allowed the use of currency in our Community Corrections Center. Work release facilities, by their very nature, imply that people must work, and with that, pay bills, provide for their own families, transportation, and needed items. About 2 years ago, we were informed that currency is contraband applied to our community correction center. Since that time, we've had to develop a fairly extensive accounting and monitoring system for offenders. We have over 100 people a day that leave our facility for work and other activities, and each person that leaves, and when they depart and return, we must document, receive their money, and then receipt and audit that at least once each shift to maintain accuracy of the money in the.
May I interrupt you, Mr. Gates?
Yes, sir.
Only because I have no one signed up against this bill, and I'll ask the committee members if they just want to ask you questions or if there's anyone that has any opposition to it. Representative Przanski, did you want to inquire?
Yeah, I don't think I have any opposition, but I do want to get a clarification. Where did you hear, who told you that your facility was in violation of the contraband rule?
Excuse me. I received a letter from our county council, from our district attorney at that time, Mr. Scott Upham, and that was approximately May of 1997.
I mean, is that based on that it was under state law that the county was in violation by allowing the money to stay with the individual, or it seems to me, Mr. Chair, that a county should be able to establish for their own local community corrections facility what they deemed to be contraband or not to be contraband.
If I may, Russell Przanski, it appears that the statute defines a few essential items and then allows them to define more, but this is sort of the lowest common denominator, and this will allow us to pull back a little bit on the lowest common denominator. Is that the way it works?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I just had one question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Senate Bill 735 raised the level of crime for having contraband to a Class C felony, or is it already current state law?
It's currently a Class C felony at this time.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Gates, the reason I interrupted you is sometimes you probably rather have to build than to have time. And as if you're in that position right now, I'll move us into a work session on Senate Bill 735. Representative Przanski?
I'll move Senate Bill 735 A and Gross to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, and with a sufficient number of members present, the motion is carried. Senate Bill 735 sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members.
Very welcome.
Senator Carrier.
Do you want us in Hampshire, carry this? We ought to give you some time for that,
yeah? He says,
oh, I'd enjoy it.
Will the fine reps in Hampshire carry that bill? I close the work session at Senate Bill 735. We're going to skip one for a moment and move to 865. We'll move into public hearing at Senate Bill 865. I've got Kevin Campbell, who is jolly out of the, in the hallway right now from the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police.
Do you want me to grab him?
Thank you, Representative Bowman, and I'll ask counsel to touch base as to what the bill's all about.
Mr. Chairman, what this bill does is allows the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to adopt some rules, setting up a program where honorably retired police officers can maintain their certification.
Mr. Campbell, good morning. Welcome to the committee. Through the courtesies of Representative Bowman, you've been brought in from the hallway.
Thank you, Representative Bowman.
No problem, Mr. Campbell.
I appreciate that.
You're the only witness signed up for Senate Bill 865. I've not gotten any adverse mail, and I want to know if you want to tell us why we ought to adopt this bill in 1 minute or less.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the chiefs of police have requested this bill because currently an honorably retired police officer, and in particular in our association's case, a chief of police that's been retired honorably, and is fulfilling often a role in cities where they have a chief that has been fired, has left, and they're in the process of transition from one chief to another. They bring in an executive, and these honorably retired police chiefs are a great resource. Unfortunately, currently, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training really has no way of extending their certification beyond a certain point, nor have they set up rules for how they might create an opportunity for continuing training that would qualify them for continued certification. This bill would allow that and would allow them then to pay a fee to continue their certification.
Representative Pazansky?
Mr. Chair, two things. I guess one, there's no opposition from DPSST.
No, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Unfortunately, Diane Middle could not be here this morning, but they actually are supportive of the bill and appeared in the Senate in support.
And secondly, if I could, Mr. Chair, I assume that these employees, or let's say former employees, could in fact qualify under the state PERS program of up to another 600 hours per year?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that's true.
I have a question, too. Do you want us to keep this bill so it can be a vessel for 20 or so items that we passed out that the Senate may not have time to get to, and we could just add them?
No, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, but no thank you.
I think we better look for it. We'll give you safe passage.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I deeply appreciate that.
Gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Campbell, reading the bill, it says retired police officer, so that fits a very broad view. I assume that sometimes police officers are asked to retire because it's easier than going through some other long process. So my concern is, I know like in Portland, it was wonderful having Chief Potter be able to step into some other roles because he was a wonderful police chief who retired and still very well respected. I guess I don't see in this bill, how do you avoid someone who retired for other than honorable reasons, even though it wouldn't show up on paperwork, from being hired back to perform that role again for a while?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Bowman, I think the key here is the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training rules. That's where they really narrow this down, and they would take care of that and would tightly address that issue. It's a good question. And
Representative,
and I guess maybe for comfort level for Representative Bowman, on line 19, it actually says honorable retired police, which makes me feel more comfortable, too, because I do understand where there are sometimes situations that you suggested.
Would these be considered independent contractors?
Withdraw the question.
I don't know.
Mr. Chair, I think I've used more than my minute of allotted time.
Okay. He's getting smarter as the session goes on.
Some people would.
We'll move to the work session on Senate Bill 865, Representative Pazansky.
Mr. Chair, I'll move SB 865 as presented to this committee to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, sufficient members being present, the motion is carried. Senate Bill 865 sent to the floor with a due pass. Representative Pazansky, you want to carry this?
Sure.
Representative Pazansky will be the carrier. I close the work session on Senate Bill 865. I'm trying to work through some quick ones here. Senate Bill 1229. We'll move into public hearing on Senate Bill 1229. keep those Senate bills moving. Come on up. We'll get the sign-up sheet. I said come on up to the apparent proponents, and I'll find out who's officially signed up in a moment. Counsel, do you want to give us a thumbnail sketch of the bill?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. What this bill does is requires any Oregon law enforcement agency that receives a report of a stolen boat to notify the State Marine Board within 72 hours after receiving the report, and conversely, if a stolen boat is recovered, to also notify the board about that fact within 72 hours. It makes it a Class A misdemeanor to file a false report of a theft of a boat, among other things.
All right, colleagues, we've got the bill here, and gentlemen, introduce yourselves to the record and give us your quick pitch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. We're in full support of Senate Bill 1229. We work closely with the Oregon State Sheriff's Association Marine Affairs Committee, which is chaired by Sheriff John Reichel, who's with me this morning, in developing this bill. It establishes a record-keeping requirement for boat theft reports. Presently, we don't receive many of those, and consequently, as the agency that issues titles, which prove ownership, it's a problem insofar as if we don't have a report on these stolen boats, it's possible for us to issue a subsequent title change inadvertently, not knowing that the boat has been reported stolen. The bill provides that if we have a boat in the system during the process, and it has been flagged as stolen, we'll discontinue processing, notify the law enforcement agency that initiated the theft report, and they have to clear that before we can subsequently issue a new title. It does create a crime of filing a false or fraudulent report. Many times boat thieves will create a paper trail for a boat that's non-existent and then file an insurance claim against this kind of boat. This would crack down on that aspect of it. So we're in full support of the bill.
Mr. Pazansky.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure if this isn't already occurring, will there be some type of listing of hot boats? So if someone takes a boat and they go out to another lake away from where it was stolen, that if a Marine patrol was out on that lake, they would be able to run some checks, like to, I would say, Ledge. I don't know who would have it, but somehow that we can maybe actually intervene on those individuals and those boats at that time.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Przanski, there will be a system that provides better documentation of boat thefts in lines 25 and 26. No, excuse me, lines 22 through 24. There's a provision for the board to create periodic reports for law enforcement agencies of stolen boats in the state. And in addition, they are in the LEDS system.
That's probably, to me, more important that they're in the LEDS, because it's one thing to get a sheet that could be outdated or maybe never get to the right people, as compared to if they run a check. If it's coming up on a statewide system, that'd be great.
The current problem is that we don't, as the titling agency, we don't have access to LEDS.
Do we need a change on that?
Mr. Chair.
Not this morning. This bill. But that would be helpful at another time. All right. Representative Przanski, do this.
I would assume at this point that when you do this, you're giving the information like the sheet to state police for them to enter it into the system.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Przanski, when a law enforcement agency has a boat theft report, they can enter that directly into the LEDS system themselves.
And that is happening. I understand they can't. I just want to make sure, because to me this is one of those things that, I mean, I don't own a boat, but I see a lot of people that seem to be very trusting as to letting their boats just kind of be there without being chained to anything anchored, and it would seem that there might be a little joyriding out there on the waves. I'd be able to intercept.
Representative Hansen?
Well, I'm real ignorant in this area, but Do boats have the equivalent of the vehicle identification number, and do the motors, which I could see as being another problem in terms of stealing outboard motors and connecting them to a different boat, are you able to track boat number when you register a boat, do you register the motor with it too?
Chairman, Representative Hansen. No, we don't register or title the outboards or the motors, but there is the equivalent of a vehicle identification number on the hull of every boat. In fact, there are two numbers. There's a visible number, and then there's a hidden number. It's known as the hull identification number. It's a federally assigned number. It's the equivalent of a VIN, and that's what we use to as a unique identifier for every boat.
All right. Sheriff, did you want to make some remarks here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Reichel, Clatsop County Sheriff, and I appear before you today as the Oregon State Sheriff's Association Chair of the Marine Affairs Committee. We think this is a good bill. It aligns the boating industry and the boating report theft much more similar to how it is with vehicles. It is accessible through LEDs by the reporting agencies, and with the requirement that those agencies are the ones responsible for clearing it. It makes the checks much more prudent, and it also does put the stopgap in there to where the link, it creates a link with the Oregon Marine Board to make sure that any new title action is prevented on a reported stolen vessel.
Very well. Mr. Horton had a question.
For legislative history purposes, I do have a quick question. And Mr. Don Hefner, I know the State Marine Board is not a business, but neither is it a law enforcement agency. My question is, would the electronic file system that Section 2, Subsection 3 requires you to maintain basically be business records? Akin to business records, I'm thinking for hearsay purposes.
You want to answer yes to that question?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Thank you.
Thank you. That's lawyer talk.
Just needed to get that on the legislative record.
Your records are akin to business records for hearsay purposes, which would allow those records to be used in evidence.
Good answer.
Good answer. Thank you.
And Mr. Rice is saying objection.
As a prosecutor, excellent answer.
We all understand that now, right, Mr. Donovan?
Yes.
Very good.
Good.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We'll move into work session on Senate Bill 1229. Representative Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, I'll move it to the floor. You pass recommendation.
Colleagues, Representative Brzezinski moves that Senate Bill 1229 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the number of members being present, the motion is carried. Senate Bill 1229 is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, you've been so successful on these voting ones, I'm wondering if you'd like to carry this one.
Yeah, I'll carry this one without any lead weights or anchors or whatever. All right, Senate Bill 1229, I'll carry to the floor. Thank you. That concludes the work session on Senate Bill 1229. We'll now move into public hearing on Senate Bill 848. Council, would you go ahead and summarize the measure?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. What this bill does is to create a Class A misdemeanor for pointing a light from a laser on a uniformed police officer if it is done intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly. And I should clarify that laser is not something that is actually used to necessarily penetrate something, but rather just the light itself is what is designated by laser in this instance.
Very well. Our first witness up is Jim Botwitness from the Oregon State Police Officer Association. Good morning and welcome to the committee.
Good morning, sir.
It occurred to me after a while, I hope we weren't getting in the way of your duty assignments for today. Okay. Because I remember one other day you had to be out of here, and here we were sitting chatting about employment law. But anyway, here we are now. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Jim Botwitness. I'm the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. I'm here today on behalf of approximately 600 state troopers in support of Senate Bill 848. This bill is intended to prohibit persons from directing light from laser pointers onto uniformed peace officers. The penalty for violating this proposed statute would be a Class A misdemeanor. It is unfortunate that laser pointers, which were designed for educational and recreational use, are now being used to play practical jokes or, worse yet, to frighten their unsuspecting target. It is unfortunate that we are here asking you to consider such legislation. However, people need to understand that these devices should be used only for their intended purpose. In the performance of their jobs, police officers make many split-second decisions. One of those split-second decisions is how to defend themselves and or citizens from injury or death. The emission of red light, whether from a laser-sighted weapon or a laser pointer, is the same and requires a split-second decision. A police officer should not have to make a split-second decision on whether the red dot that's on his or her chest is from a weapon or a laser pointer, and whether it requires the use of deadly physical force. I made some inquiries within our own organization if we had any state troopers that were involved in particular incidents involving laser pointers. We did have two officers that I was able to come up with. One was here in Salem, That's in my testimony. The other one was in the Astoria area during the process of conducting a vehicle stop, and quite frankly, it frightened the tire out of both of them. Having this red dot on their chest, not knowing what it was on the other end of that. Oregon is not the only state that is considering legislation or already has legislation in place. New York already has legislation in place. Recently, the governor of the state of Washington signed an unlawful discharge of laser bills, which will become law later this year, and I have attached that bill to my testimony. California, Connecticut, Wisconsin, and Iowa all have legislation before them, and we understand that the states are considering legislation. While Senate Bill 848 makes it unlawful to direct a laser pointer at a peace officer, the aforementioned states are including such issues as sales of point laser pointers and pointing a laser pointer at anyone. I believe it's appropriate.
Mr. Botwin, we're going to interrupt you for a moment. Okay. We do have your written testimony, Representative Pazansky.
I guess there's only one thing. I think it's fine, but I'm wondering why we're going to limit this just to police officers. I've heard the problems of people having lasers pointed through and hitting, like, the rearview mirrors and back in their eyes and doing the same thing. Should we not maybe make this across the board?
Mr. Chair, Representative Prozanski, from our perspective, when we started this bill, we had kind of hoped that maybe it was going to be a blanket bill with maybe a couple of different categories as far as the crime level was concerned, because we do in fact know of incidents where the laser has been pointed to the rearview mirror of the car and it's temporarily blinded the operator of the vehicle. We know of incidents where cars have come side by side and somebody's pointed a laser out the side of their window as though they were pointing a weapon at somebody. We know of an incident where a school bus driver had laser pointer pointed into the outside rearview mirror. It came back and into her eyes and temporarily blinded her. So we certainly don't have any problems with this bill being expanded to include anyone as far as I'm concerned.
I think the concern might be the phrase fiscal impact statement at this stage of the session. That is, if we broaden it, and I'm open to it, Representative Sansky, I'm just watching for a report from the courts or somebody telling us that somehow it's going to have a free prison cell impact and all of a sudden we're into ways and means. But that's just a background question, Representative Sansky.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd like to see if we couldn't ask administrator staff to put out the feelers to Bill Lemon or whoever, because I mean the way I look at it, this is some people are going to see this as a law enforcement only bill because that's what it is. When there's a problem, I think beyond that all of us recognize.
Okay.
And we should at least look at it.
I'm open to that, just as long as we do check out the potential anchor. And I think you're going to find that we're very receptive to this, Mr. Botwin. We appreciate you bringing this to us. Representative Simmons?
I am more inclined to make a motion to adopt the Dash 2s and move the bill.
On 848? What Dash 2s?
Dash 2s
Dash 2 that bills are
I better flip through my packet here.
Standards include private security officers.
Oh, I see.
Who are on duty? Who is on duty?
Are you thinking that we may have constitutional problems if we try to broaden this a little too far this session?
Why? Well, I mean, if we can have a discussion.
Sure.
I mean, if we're going to open this up to not only law enforcement, but then the private security officers, many of these individuals have no weapons of their own, but we're going to leave general citizens out of the bill. I guess I'm kind of concerned or kind of interested as to what the constitutional problem of being able to get 31.
Just because where I'm hearing it from is the only reason I ask it. Representative Simmons?
I'm not convinced that a jury wouldn't, if somebody had a laser pointer and say drop it, that's reckless. And it flashes across somebody's chest and all of a sudden they're up for a Class A misdemeanor charge. I could see a jury or convicting someone or an aggressive DA convicting someone in a situation like that, and I'm not willing to go there.
Well, there's two elements here. One is I'm concerned about intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly. I think it seems to me that we could be talking about that. Yes, I think recklessly needs to be taken out of there.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, there's no doubt in my opinion we should have that out as a prosecutor. I mean, someone's got to be intentionally or knowingly at least doing that act. Reckless, I mean, it's...
Well, let's do this. We have three other people signed up to testify, and we can wait a couple of days for a work session to see where the dust settles. I'm open to a variety of approaches here, as long as we get to the baseline of protecting officers who are trained to react to these things. And there is an important distinction for a peace officer who is trained to be prepared and is subjected to this and their reaction, as opposed to the ordinary citizen who may be harmed or offended or upset in certain cases, but other times may not know how to react, or kids shoot, aiming these things at each other, playing games. But let's do this. Let Mr. Botwin, go ahead and finish your remarks, and I'll mention as an idea that we could also talk about it being a violation for citizens to do this to citizens and make it a much higher offense to do it to police officers, knowing that in their situation it's much more of a concern. Go ahead, Mr. Botwin.
Okay, I'll just close out real briefly by saying that, again, that we don't have any objection to this bill being expanded if the committee sees fit to do that in whatever fashion, you know, they want to add to the bill. The people we've talked to, it's a pretty frightening experience for most anybody. You have a red dot leveled off on you, whether you're in a car or school bus or whatever, and it's a pretty frightening experience. We just ask that Senate Bill 848 receive a due pass recommendation, and thank you for your interest in this bill.
Thank you. Roger Greenfield, Salem Police Department. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Chairman Mannix, members of the committee, my name is Roger Greenfield. I'm a police officer with the City of Salem. I've been a police officer involved in the criminal justice system for over 25 years, and I guess you could say I'm in the twilight of my career. I recently completed assignment with the Regional Salem Police, Marion County Regional Gang Response Team, who specifically dealt with gang violence and intelligence gathering. Any sort of incident involving gang violence, our team was called in and did our investigation. I first became acquainted with laser pointers in casual conversation with documented known gang members. And I used the term documented known gang members to qualify my testimony here with these close folks. We develop a personal relationship many times with known gang members. They'll talk with members of the gang response team. On one particular occasion, I had an opportunity to talk with about six or eight of them in an apartment complex in the evening hours. I noticed that all of them were carrying pens, fountain pens. And I inquired with them, what are you guys carrying fountain pens for? They say, well, we're into writing. Well, why don't we qualify that a little bit, gentlemen? Why don't you tell me what the fountain pens are for? At that time, they produced a laser light. Each one of them, they had purchased them locally. I asked them, why in the world would you want to carry something like that? They simply responded, it's like carrying a gun. And at that point, I became rather concerned, and I said, explain that to me, gentlemen. And they said, well, we can shine it into rival gang members. They referred to another gang. Shine it in their eyes, we can blind them, then we can take care of our business. One of them, through casual conversation, simply said, we could shine it in your eye and take your gun. I was concerned when I heard that. At that point, I began to hear about other laser weapons being used in other parts of the country, and I'll reference in January of this year two Chicago police officers that were shot by gang members. One of them was killed. A laser light was pointed into his eyes. It blinded him. He was not able to react, and he was shot dead. The other officer was able to react, even though and was seriously wounded. It became because of a laser light. Another occasion occurred here in Salem when I was at the Lancaster Mall during Christmas time, off duty, sitting in the coffee shop area, having a soda. A laser light, I observed, was at a neighboring table being pointed. I attempted immediately to locate it. That laser light moved to my chest. Ladies and gentlemen, I can tell you my heart fell out on the floor. I'm trained to react. I'm trained to make split decisions that may or may not involve taking human life. I didn't know what to do. But I did react. I got down on the floor and went for my off-duty gun. The light then disappeared. Kids moved away. There was a lot of people in there in this local mall, which had been the scene of two gang-related shootings inside them in the mall. And I went home very, very, very scared. I think that it's important that you understand that we make split decisions, and I know you do, that take the Supreme Court years to decide. Ladies and gentlemen, I have been in a deadly force situation. I pray that that never, ever happens to me and my family again. But I do not want to see some child killed because a police officer has to make these split decisions by pointing a laser light at a police officer. I truly believe through education, the media, through other means of communicating with parents, that we can provide that proper education. But I truly believe that we need a very, very good law involving laser lights, especially at police officers. I totally agree with the other comments about other citizens. I think there's a degree, Washington has degrees in their law on that. But I also would like to see it expanded to firefighters and other emergency medical technicians. And the politics of this, I rest with you. But I, on behalf of the Salem Police Officers Association, stand in support.
Sergeant, I appreciate that. What do you think about the idea of Class A misdemeanor for firefighters, paramedics, and persons similarly situated, police officers, and uniformed security officers, and a Class A misdemeanor in those cases, take out recklessly, make it intentionally or knowingly, and then also for citizens generally, make it a Class C misdemeanor. So it's a crime, a lower level crime, but there's some recognition of the fact it shouldn't be done.
I agree. And I do, from the investigative standpoint, where the on a Class A misdemeanor, officers are able to complete their investigations through probable cause, the fruits of the crime element, I think is real important with that, which allow you to take immediate action on that. And, you know, it doesn't mean hauling somebody off the jail every time that happens. We have the opportunity to write citations to appear. And I think that the officers have those discretionary authorities. I concur with that wholeheartedly.
All right. Thank you. Representative Przanski.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm kind of penciling out here some different changes. I guess what I would suggest for the mens rea would be just knowingly, because intentionally would automatically be picked up with that. And then if I heard the chair correctly, for the Class A, it would be public safety officers, as we have now for, like, on the assault on a public safety officer, which would broaden and take in
corrections officers
and firefighters, I believe. But I think it's important that, as the chair said, if we're going to bring in the private security, that there needs to be some other distinction. The uniformed ones that are in uniform would probably be the way that you can do it, because you're not going to. I guess you're going to get down to a point that if you don't have some type of break in that sense, you're going to have people that potentially could be pointing that should be, or they may consider it be a Class C as a private person, but because they're employed as a security guard who's off duty, not in uniform, they're still going to be this cross of treated as an A or a C.
But if you made it uniformed, then it'd be clear.
Right. And then that falls pretty much in what we're talking about with the assault on public safety officer having the difference of a penalty, potential Class C felony as compared to a Class A misdo.
Okay. Further questions? Yes.
No, well, not a question.
Right. Let's call up then. Thank you very much. It was sergeant, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, it's officer now.
Oh, sorry.
Different agency. It was a sergeant.
Okay. Thank you very much. Kurt Curtis. Sergeant Kurt Curtis, State Police. That one I got right.
Thank you. Representative Mannix, members of the committee. My name is Kurt Curtis, and I'm a sergeant with the Oregon State Police. I come before the committee with no written prepared testimony other than in support of the bill. Also, I do have a demonstration here where I will be bringing out a weapon. It has been secured. in a way that we hope that it won't discharge, but bring that before you.
You have our permission.
We're not going to be pointing it that direction. I would add one other thing based on the conversations that I've heard here is possibly add public official to your list. I would feel real uneasy about a situation that a red light was pointed on one of your chests or when you're out publicly speaking, this type of thing, or a known official came to this state from some other area and all of a sudden had laser lights and we had to move them out of the way. But that's
what if we said elected public official in the course of their official duties?
That would be fine.
Maybe we'll make them a Class B misdemeanor and fit them between officers who are peace officers. And I say that only a little facetiously in the sense that there ought to be protection for all citizens. Probably to keep it simple, though, at this point, we'll probably say all citizens, maybe Class C misdemeanor, and then...
Since we're citizen legislators.
We're citizen legislators. But that at least that way you do have a crime scenario there. And I would say, too, that under certain circumstances, you're probably talking about an opportunity to arrest somebody for assault under certain circumstances, too, if they're giving a speech and someone points a laser at them. And no, I don't know if that would fit. That would fit some civil concepts of assault. Well, we'll worry about that as we work on this, but I appreciate your point.
What I have here for the members of the committee to observe, this is a laser pointer purchased from Office Max, under $20. Concern is the broad barrel of the unit, the red light as it shines. A lot of people haven't had a chance to look at what a laser pointer, or they have seen a laser pointer. This is another unit purchased at Costco. It's a laser pointer, $18. Fairly readily accessible. This is a Glock 40 caliber. It has a laser sight on it. The sighting on this particular weapon, this particular unit you can purchase for $600 here in the local area. I called two gun dealers. I gave them no references to my occupation, just said that I've got a brand new Glock semi-automatic. I was told I could create a laser sight for it. How much? They said, well, there's an outfit in Portland, and we'll send it up there. One was $595, one was $600 to have it mounted on the unit. This particular weapon belongs to a citizen here who is a security guard in the Salem area that is a friend of mine that I borrowed it from. He picked it up for $900 at a gun show with a laser sight on it.
We won't ask whether there was a concealed background check run, but
no, he does have a concealed weapons permit. The point being, these laser sights are available. They come in varying sizes. Some mount onto the trigger guard up front, extend a little bit further. Some are back further. They're available from anywhere to, I've seen them from $200 to thousands of dollars, just depending on it. It doesn't have to be the big full-caliber rifle like you see in the SWAT movies or the movies, this type of thing with a laser sight. It's as simple as a small handgun like this, and they will mount on even smaller guns. And that's where our concern is for the safety of the officers, because we teach our officers to react, especially when there's a fear or a possible fear. And unfortunately, we react basically in three-quarters of a second to a second in some instances, and then we have to think about it afterwards. And other people have chances of many hours to think about our actions.
In that sense, this is tantamount to somebody pointing a firearm at you, even though you don't know whether it's loaded or unloaded. Your reaction has to be that a firearm is being pointed at you, and you must assume that it is loaded and act accordingly.
Exactly. You have a dark hallway situation or an alleyway. You've been chasing a suspect. You might have come around the corner and someone's pointing a laser light back at you. You have another situation where you're driving your automobile. All of a sudden, this red dot comes through the glass and it's on your chest. We're going to take evasive action because we don't know exactly what's being pointed at us until we've had a chance to check it out.
And, of course, in part of your training is in responding as defensively, but you can't respond offensively unless you've identified the perpetrator, and then you truly identify that someone is doing something that is about to endanger you. In other words, you can't just fire blindly in the direction of the laser.
Exactly.
But whatever the rationale for someone doing that, you're in a situation where your life may be immediately threatened, and you have to react that way.
That's the major concern that comes first, sir. Thank you.
Questions for the witness, Representative Gianella.
Mr. Chairman, Sergeant Curtis, do you have to pull the trigger to have the red light go on? How does that operate?
Representative Mannix, Representative Gianella, as soon as I put my finger around the trigger guard, there's a little button right up here. As soon as that finger touches the top of it, that light comes on. I don't have to sight down the barrel to sight this. As soon as I know where that dot is, I can pull the trigger. It's accurate to several hundred feet. So it's just basically, as soon as I see the light where I want it to be, boom, it's gone. And I can pull the trigger at the same time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul, Reverend Simmons?
Explain to me the health hazards of laser pointers.
Well, I can tell you this.
Other than he uses laser sights, obviously.
Okay. There's warnings. I don't have the written warnings with me that come with each of these. It's clearly marked on each of the units. If I just... The laser pointers and even this laser light, prolonged exposure to the eye can cause damage to the eye. It can be a blinding effect as it's shined in. You have quite a bright light that's coming through.
Like a bright photography flash or more damaging long term?
Representative Mannix, Representative Simmons, I'm not an expert in that field, so I really couldn't say what type of damage. Other than the fact that there are warnings on both of those.
We have someone present who used to work for a laser pointer company. He just advised me. Mr. Horton.
That is true, Mr. Chairman. Before law school, I did work for a laser pointer company, which was owned by Representative Patridge's father. And in answer to Representative Simmons' question, it can do permanent damage to, I believe it's the retina, but usually 1 or 2 seconds of exposure is not going to do that. There can be temporary blindness, but permanent blindness can result if I were to hold this here and it would do damage to the retina.
Go up close and look at it.
Well, it doesn't even have to be up close. It could be if I were to shine this on the witness's eye and if it were to get the right angle and if he were to be looking not only directly at it but away. My understanding of how laser pointers can work is that there is a possibility, and it's not a real small possibility, but somewhere in the range of under 50% to permanent damage. As to how many documented cases there are of that, I certainly can't tell you.
Mr. Chair.
Reverend Bowman.
This sounds like another legal product that maybe should be only sold to adults. I guess I'm really concerned that we're continuing to criminalize something that you can legally have. I mean, I go back to the inhalant and how difficult that's going to be to actually prosecute someone for having something that they can legally have. So I just wanted to say that for the record, that we're going down this road that, you know, anything legal, you can use it illegally. And so if we're going to continue to create crimes whereby you're using something that, other than its intended purpose, then we're going to end up with an awful lot of crimes for things that are traditionally legal to do.
And on the other hand, it's legal to have a butcher knife, and the only thing that's illegal is how you use it. And I can...
Well, right. It's not a crime until you stab somebody with it.
Well, or swing it at them. I mean, there's various levels. That's what we have to continue to look at. And this is a product which can be used in many commercial and industrial applications, and harmlessly and appropriately. The problem is when someone decides to use it for other purposes. And I know with inhalants, whipped cream apparently is, you know, something we put on our pie, but you can also snort the gas as you're pumping the whipped cream and get a brief high and also possibly fry your brains out. It's amazing. Representative Hansen?
Well, I'd like to see, I've got no problems in terms of the way this relates to police officers, because certainly there's a differential from the standpoint of pointing one of these at somebody that's armed creates an incredibly dangerous circumstance that we need to do something on. On some of the other aspects of it, I would think that
it's also a Class C felony to carry a cell phone or a pager. I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
If the citizen's not armed, it seems to me there's another usage in terms of like flashing them into a driver's eyes, a rear view mirror, something like that. I would think that would be covered by current law on endangering and some form of an assault. I mean, that's a really dangerous practice that I would think shining them into the eyes of a school bus driver with 50 kids on board, we ought to be able to prosecute, and I'll leave this to the prosecutors, that they ought to be able to react to that type of activity right now.
Yeah.
But somehow I don't want to get so broad that 13-year-old kids that are playing tag with these items, which might not be the most responsible conduct on earth, but I can see it could be awfully compelling activity to a minor that's not really creating a danger or hurting somebody. I don't know if we want to go that far with it. One thought would be if you kept it limited to police officers during this session, it would give us an opportunity really to the impact of us passing a law and publicizing that might have more of an impact than if we tried to broadly utilize it and then come back next session and define it a little closer depending on how the technology is being used. But certainly this on a police officer is an incredibly dangerous situation.
You could also have it knowingly without the consent of the person who's being targeted, because certainly there may be practice sessions where people are aiming lasers at one another for some reasons, but these are things we're going to have to filter through. Mr. DeLashmet, I'll get my last witness, our last witness, so good morning.
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman. Brian DeLashmet, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. We support this legislation and would be interested in looking at the graduated sanctions that you've discussed. I think there is some validity in protection of all public, but the overriding, obviously, issue here was the response that a police officer would have, a typical response to being flashed with one of these, and the potential danger that does. So, again, we'd support the bill in this form or a modified form.
And, excuse me, again, we don't have anything here about consent, so if there was a training session where officers consented to be had lasers aimed back and forth for training, I don't know if that ever happened. If you're doing training...
I mean, do they do that? Do paintball guns have
that's where I
guns?
Think you'd have to have a consent exception without the consent of the person against whom the laser is aimed. That would take care of your kids who are playing with each other, too. I've already seen one instance on my street where one kid went down the block and the other one was aiming it at him for fun. But then we'll worry later about telling them about the dangers of getting it into their eyes. This is a graduated response, I think. I've heard concerns already from some notes that perhaps we ought to talk about a violation for citizens this time in Class A misdemeanor for peace officers and then move from there over time to see. I'd say if we took out recklessly and we talked about knowingly as a standard as recommended by Representative Pozanski, kept it Class A misdemeanor, follow Representative Pozanski's suggestion to include, was it public safety officers as the official category, and talked about to avoid the concerns that I've heard from others, a violation for citizen to citizen, and add the requirement that this be done without the consent of the person to whom the aiming has occurred, then you've got it pretty well refined for a starting point. I'm just suggesting this. What's your reaction, gentlemen?
I think that's pretty logical.
It would be very logical, yes.
Not that surprises me, but that's pretty logical.
What's
the at this point in the legislative session, doing something very logically.
This committee is the Magnificent Seven, Mr. DeLashmet.
Exactly. You'll get no
Eight.
Argument from me, sir.
All right, Representative Pozanski.
I think
session started at 10.
First, I've got a couple of things I was going to say.
Representative Simmons?
I just was going to comment that darts are probably more lethal. Hand darts you throw at a target, probably more lethal to the eye. And they're not illegal. We have no law saying you can't throw them at each other. I mean, not that I think it's a good
better
idea.
Better not hit somebody. Now,
we don't have that specifically, right, in law. And although I'm comfortable with the, because laser pointers are associated with sighting devices, with making it illegal to point one at an officer in the line of duty or some of the others that we've talked about, I'm not ready to expand it to the citizenry as a whole at this point.
Representative Gianella.
Mr. Chairman, I'm comfortable with this solely like it was in the beginning, intended for law enforcement. I'm very comfortable with it that way in its present form.
Well, I guess the real shift that we're going to have to talk about is whether or not the general public is added to this. Representative Przanski?
You know, I was looking as we're talking and hearing stuff as to what we could do today, what's current. Reckless endangering, possibly, but there it requires a substantial risk of serious physical injury to another. Harassment, which is offensive physical contact, and we are making changes with the levels of different harassment, and we may be able to plug something in there as compared to maybe creating a brand new law, if that's causing any concerns where it would be broader in exposure, and you could have the graduated type of structure. It just, I mean, seeing the demonstration of three dots, to me, they all look like the same, and who's to say what's what? And if we're going into whatever style of handgun ownership, the Vermont style or whatever, we could have a few people that's going to be reacting because all of a sudden they'd see something on their chest. I really think that this is something that we want to take a very serious look at and getting a serious message out, but graduating it for the different communities who are trained to react. I mean, if we have to piecemeal it out, maybe that's what we end up doing. But I mean, it's going to take one incident where somebody has a laser point on their chest, and they're going to be carrying a handgun, and they're going to react just like an officer would. And I mean, I don't want us to say, "Gosh, maybe we should have done something 2 years ago when this happens."
Well, that's why I think the way we'll work this, we'll bring this bill back with two sets of amendments. I think there's agreement about the uniformed security officer. There's agreement about public safety officer as the generic group. There's agreement about taking out recklessly and just focusing on knowingly, which is actually a notch below intentionally, and then you've got good broad coverage. And we can have one amendment then that raises the question as to whether, and by the way, also this is without the consent of the person who is subjected to the targeting. And then we have the choice as to whether we make it a violation for a member of the public to be the target. Excuse me. And we'll have some further discussion about that and see where we want to go. Violation or Class C misdemeanor, and we could have both of those options presented. Sure. And have a discussion at our work session. Let's try to have a work session on Wednesday on this bill. We'll also bring back 2352 for a work session if it's not set tomorrow on Wednesday. And 3049, Representative Sinceri, before he left, indicated he opposes the -2 amendments. I'll mention that to John Helen. So that, as of right now, that bill doesn't have legs unless you can convince Representative Sinceri there's some version of it that he supports. So we'll carry that over. If that's set for tomorrow, we'll leave it set for tomorrow. If it's not, we'll set it for Wednesday.
I apologize. I was reading something else. We're talking about one of the bills coming back or not coming back.
2352, we'll take a look at that Wednesday for work session with the -4 amendments. And 3049 with the -2 amendments, depending on whether or not there's adequate support, and that's up to the proponents of the measure.
This is one for the study?
Yeah, and that would have to go. No, this one is.
This one is.
Yeah, it's just the Attorney General study on lawsuits. That would have to go to Ways and Means if we approved it.
Why? I was looking at, you know, when I heard this before and it had a very high price tag, I see that it's come down for the biennium, where it seems to be, it's down to 25.
Is this 3049?
-2.
-2, says 25,000.
And I mean, at first when it was up over the 50,000, did it make sense? I mean,
well, the only reason that is this is an appropriation itself. The bill itself makes an appropriation. There's a science to making an appropriation in this bill.
I thought the $50,000 was our limit. I'm just kind of.
If there's a fiscal impact of $50,000 or less, we can send it out. But if it makes any appropriation, even $1,
gotcha,
we have to send it to Ways and Means. But I'll leave it up to John Helen and company to talk to Representative Sinceri and others to see what kind of support there is.
Mr. Chair, we sure didn't do that earlier in the session. I'm remembering Representative Simmons' bill that had the $50,000, the $45,000 appropriation to OLCC that we sent directly to the floor.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. You're right. You're right, Representative Bowman. You must not have a gold standard here. Okay. maybe this appropriation will have to be $60,000. Touche, as they say.
Thanks, and make it go.
All right. Thank you, and we are adjourned. I expect we'll have a work session Wednesday. Thank you.